It's been the hottest bestseller in the year 1997, a book entitled Into Thin Air. Why are people so fascinated by the triumphs and the tragedies on Mount Everest? There are some powerful spiritual lessons about pride, guilt, and forgiveness to be found at 29,000 feet. Welcome to the Voice of Prophecy. This is Lonnie Melashenko. Join us today as we search for ways to make this a better world and prepare for the world to come.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new radio adventure here on the Voice of Prophecy. I'm Kenneth Richards. It really has ridden the New York Times bestseller chart for most of this year, Into Thin Air. And now we're beginning a 10-part series of our own entitled The Everest Chronicles. In a few minutes, we'll be sharing another excellent book entitled Your Most Radical Decision. But first, let's go right into the best book of all, God's Word. Here's Lonnie with today's message, Proud of Getting Clear to the Top.
Thanks, Ken. It happened back in the year 1852 in the offices of the Great Trigonometrical Survey of India, nestled in the northern hills of Dehradun. There was a computer, which in those days meant a human, a mathematician named Radhanath Sikdar with a sharpened pencil who had been working and adding up long columns of figures in the Calcutta Bureau. And this Bengali number cruncher had just discovered the highest mountain in the world, using triangulation numbers from six survey sites in northern India. Figuring in all the trigonometry, plus curvature of the earth, atmospheric refraction, and plumb line deflection, he reported that peak 15, as it was then called, was 29,002 feet above sea level, the world's highest point. 9 years later, the mountain was named Everest in honor of Sir George Everest, a prior surveyor general for India. And almost immediately, adventurous men and mountaineering enthusiasts decide that if this was the tallest mountain on planet Earth, well, then it ought to be climbed. There was the North Pole, the South Pole, and now Everest was really the third pole, the third impossible to reach but we must try spot on Earth. Alpinist Günther Dirnfurt declared that getting to the top of this highest peak was, quote, a matter of universal human endeavor, a cause from which there is no withdrawal, whatever losses it may demand, end quote. Well, losses has become the tragic word of emphasis ever since. After young Mr. Sikdar's discovery in 1852, it took another 101 years, 15 expeditions, and 24 lives lost before Edmund Hillary and his Sherpa assistant, Tenzing Norgay, finally stood at the top on May 29, 1953. Some of you recall that headline. Hillary was knighted and became Sir Edmund Hillary, and soon found his face on magazine covers and postage stamps all around the world. Here in the year 1997, the world seems fascinated still by the raw terror of this silent monument of death there in the mysterious kingdom of Nepal. The death toll has gone up considerably since Hillary's achievement, and the hottest bestseller on the market right now is entitled Into Thin Air, written by John Krakauer of Seattle. A year ago last March, on assignment for Outside Magazine, he joined a profit-making organization called Adventure Consultants, headed by a New Zealander by the name of Rob Hall. His assignment was to write about the commercialization of Everest, the selling of guided trips for hackers and novices by entrepreneurs like Hall. And as many of you probably know, the trip ended in disaster with a number of climbers left up there on the roof of the world. A rogue storm blew in during the afternoon of May 10, claiming the lives of 9 climbers, including 3 of the guides. Well, what's that got to do with the spiritual focus of the Voice of Prophecy? As we read through this chilling bestseller from Random House and the account in Outside Magazine, it was striking how the story of this struggle to get to the top had such incredible power, such telling spiritual meaning. Why do people risk their lives and their fortunes, up to $65,000 per person, in doing something like this? Well, there's a lesson about pride here, about motives, about greed. But there's also heroism, a man laying down his life for his friends, guilt, forgiveness, death, and resurrection, the nearness of eternity. And in a quiet, unspoken way, maybe, there's even a sense of heaven. A man or woman stands on the roof of this world, 29,028 feet closer to heaven than the rest of us. He's up so high that the jet stream, wind howling around him, is caused by the spinning of the planet. He can almost reach out and touch the stars, feel the presence of God. We'll talk about that as well. Author John Krakauer came back from Everest, a different man. In some ways, it broke him. More than a year later, he's still trying to forgive himself for taking the risk, for participating in decisions that left others dead. What can a person do with agonizing memories, with the realization of guilt? Bodies on Everest are simply left there on the trail. He knows that the corpse of his friend Andy Harris is still up there at the south summit, and that he might have saved him. Does the Bible tell us anything that can diminish the numbing horror of culpability? Let me say one thing here that echoes what Krakauer wrote in his conclusion. He had tried to be respectful and sensitive in his manuscript, and here for the next 2 weeks, we want to do the same thing. It was a horrible thing that happened in May of 1996, and again in May of 1997. It's with sober hearts that we want to learn spiritual truth from a story like this one. Probably the four most famous words in all of mountaineering come from the legends of Everest, and they were spoken by a British climber named George Leigh Mallory. "Why do you want to climb this mountain?" a U.S. news reporter asked him. And you've heard his answer. Because it is there. In fact, he was the driving force behind the first three expeditions up the mountain. But you know, it's more than that. And even we non-climbers have to admit it. Why do we all want to climb some Everest? There are maybe good and great reasons for some of the risks we take, the bold things we try, but there's also pride. I want to be the first man to the top, the oldest man to the top, the first woman to the top, the first Melashenko to get there. In Rob Hall's expedition, a 47-year-old Japanese woman named Yasuko Namba was the oldest woman to get to the summit. Unfortunately, she died on the way down. More about that later. But friend, there's something in all of us that makes us want to get up some hill, but only if our neighbors haven't been up it. If the day ever comes when 10 million people have been to the top of Everest, if they someday install escalators and windscreens and maybe construct a weatherproof see-through tube where you can hike to the top in 70-degree comfort, then the allure will be gone. And why risk 2 months and 65 grand, and even your life, to do what 10 million others have done too? By the end of 1996, something like 630 people had stood at the top, and already some are complaining about that. Hillary himself huffed, "The crowds of novices being escorted to the top for a fee are engendering disrespect for the mountain." The achievement's been tarnished by the numbers. Pride can only be fulfilled if the numbers stay small, the club exclusive. A Seattle postal worker named Doug Hansen had gone up with Rob Hall in 1995 and eventually turned back just 300 feet from the top. Krakauer wrote later, and I quote, "Doug had spent the entire previous year agonizing over the fact that he'd gotten to within 300 feet of the summit and had to turn around. And I mean, it had gnawed at him every single day." Now, analyze something rather obvious with me. Listen, if you want a spectacular view of the Himalayas, it's not bad at all from 28,728 feet up. You can see plenty from there. And you're standing higher than a lot of your buddies at the Seattle post office back home. But why isn't 28,728 feet enough? Ah, because you've got to stand at the top. You've got to be able to go back down and tell your friends, "I climbed Everest." And did you make it to the top? Yep, I made it to the top. There's something in us that makes us want to say that. Krakauer himself, in the introduction to his book, writes how by the time he got to the summit himself at about 1:12 in the afternoon, May 10, he was completely thrashed. His mind and body were starved for air. In the past 57 hours, he hadn't slept. His entire food intake for 3 days was a bowl of ramen soup and a few M&Ms. And as he looked down on what was admittedly a spectacular sight, He simply couldn't summon the energy to care about it. Plus, he knew that every minute, every second he could spare would be needed for the often deadly trip back down. After just 5 minutes on the roof of the world, he shrugged and went back down. So it wasn't the view or the exhilaration of being at the top. It was just to be able to get back down, collapse in a tent at Camp 4, and mutter to himself, "We've done it. We've climbed Everest." Probably more than any other human emotion, and we can all understand it, it's a matter of pride. Back to British climber George Mallory, who wanted to climb Everest because it was there, and also because he had a shot at being the first man to the top. He was 38 years old, an upper-crust schoolteacher with 3 children. He was a good-looking man with all the social graces. In fact, up high on the slopes of Everest, he and his tent mates would read Hamlet to each other. On June 8, 1924, he and fellow climber Andrew Irvine headed for the top. Teammates who waited below could see through a break in the clouds and track the 2 men slowly and deliberately making their way toward the summit, driven by many passions, including pride. Did they make it to the peak? To the height that counts? 29,028 feet? We'll never know, because the 2 men never returned. The mountain swallowed them up that night. And because no one could confirm whether they got to the top, that record had to wait for Sir Edmund Hillary 29 years later. Friend, if our lives are fueled by pride, if our identities are wrapped up in made it to the top or didn't make it to the top, then we're in trouble, aren't we? More on this tomorrow, but what a necessary thing it is to see ourselves not as successful summiteers, but as children of God, people redeemed from this earth because of another hill called Calvary.
Yes, the cross of Jesus ought to be our only identity, friend, and not how high we've climbed on the mountain. Right now, Lonnie and I would like to mail you a free copy of our own, quote, bestseller, entitled Your Most Radical Decision by Lonnie and David. For your free copy of this full-length book, write The Voice of Prophecy, Box 53055, Los Angeles 90053. That's Box 53055, Los Angeles 90053. Just ask for Your Most Radical Decision. Our Canadian listeners can write to Box 2127, Oshawa, Ontario, L1H7V4. Or you can call us toll-free, U.S. or Canada, at 1-800-872-0055. Let me repeat that number, 1-800-872-0055. And please remember to include the call letters of this station. Lonnie, what's our title for tomorrow?
Thanks, Ken. Well, we have some more to discuss on the topic of pride, don't we? Here's our Tuesday topic. Yeah, but you used oxygen. Be sure to join us for all 10 segments of the Everest Chronicles and also send in for the gift book. Until next time, this is Lonnie Miloshenko reminding you that it's always true. God loves you.
Sadhu Sundar Singh was a former Hindu in India who gave his life to Jesus Christ. Once he and a companion were traveling through a pass high in the Himalayan mountains. At one point, they came across a body lying in the snow. Sundar Singh wanted to stop and help the unfortunate man, but his companion refused. "We'll lose our lives if we burden ourselves with this man," he said. But Sundar Singh refused to leave the man to die in the cold. So his companion bade him farewell and went on. Sundar Singh lifted the poor traveler onto his back, and with great difficulty he carried the man over the snow. Gradually the heat from Sundar Singh's body began to warm up the frozen fellow, and he revived. Soon both were walking together side by side. After walking for some distance, they noticed a dark heap in the snow up ahead. It was Sundar Singh's former companion, dead, frozen by the cold. And so it was that the man who was willing to lose his life on behalf of another ended up saving it. And the one who sought to save his life lost it. Strange how life works, isn't it?